Welcome to the podcast from Infotation, the independent fact-checking service to combat fake news about the coronavirus. This is the first major public health crisis in the age of social media disinformation, and we're here to try and make sense of it. I'm Damien Collins MP, co-founder of Infotation and former chair of the House of Commons Select Committee for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport. Today, I'll be joined once again by another Infotagen co-founder, John Quinlan, the CEO of Iconic Labs, and our in-house disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel, along with special guests, Sasha Havlicek, the chief executive of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and Edward Lucas, writer for The Times and The Economist, and an expert in the weaponization of fake news. So welcome to our guests to this second Infotagen podcast. And I'd like to turn first to our regular guests, John Quinlan from Iconic Labs and Dr. Charles Creel, to give us an update on what's been happening in the last few days. John, perhaps you could first off give us a bit of an update about what's been happening in Infotagen and what we've been working on.
Yeah, sure, Damien. Yeah, so it's been a busy week here. Obviously, since we spoke last week, Eamon Holmes has sort of backtracked slightly. Glad to see, but with our site, I think we've seen a variety of different ones coming in to us, and we've fact checked them. But some of the highlights, I think, are: is the US COVID-19 lockdown an anti-Trump plot, which is interesting, and then a few different aspects of it. Obviously, that's more on the impact of COVID-19, but also some stuff on like the treatment. Can an onion poultice cure COVID-19? So happy to fact check them and disprove certainly the onion one.
Exactly. I'm not really sure I want to try the onion poultice, whether or not I thought I had COVID-19. But I mean, Charles, I mean, it seems that if there's a trend in the last couple of weeks on disinformation, it's starting to shift into a slightly more political sphere, more political conspiracy theories about the origins of coronavirus, who's responsible for it, how governments are responding. Is that what you're picking up?
That's absolutely right. We are picking that up, particularly around Russian and Chinese disinformation. So there's a number of disinformation narratives that have been floated, and there's a report coming out this week from the European External Action Service's Stratcom division, that's EEA Stratcom. And this builds on some other reports that they've done in the past. So in March, they had a report that came out that showed China's leading disinformation narratives. We saw that they said that China had done a great job and the West should be grateful, that the virus didn't originate in China, but more likely in the US, and that the West had weaponized the virus in order to harm China, spread anti-Chinese sentiment, and that the US owes China and the Chinese people an apology. From the Russian side, there are two narratives. There's the domestic narrative and the international narrative. Domestically, they're saying that the virus is a form of foreign aggression and originated in U.S. labs. And this isn't that dissimilar to other disinformation narratives that have nothing to do with COVID. Internationally, they're promoting the idea that global elites are weaponizing the virus for their own ends. There are some other political aspects to the coronavirus story that's going around. There are AstroTurf protests in the U.S., which John mentioned earlier on. So a right-wing protest movement has grown up over the past 2 weeks, protesting stay-at-home orders by governors. You'll have seen the zombie protest memes floating around, comparing a photo of protesters in Ohio to a Shaun of the Dead film poster. And Trump has been supporting these with some not-so-presidential tweets calling for the liberation of Virginia, Michigan, and Minnesota. But things aren't really what they appear. And rather than grassroots, as is being claimed online, these protests are being driven by wealthy conservative organizations, including the Michigan Freedom Fund. And that organization's received $500,000 in funding from the family of Betsy DeVos, who was actually in Trump's cabinet.
It sounds quite reminiscent of the sort of fake news we saw during the presidential election in 2016, of sort of demonstrations being organized by these shadowy figures on Facebook.
Indeed, that is absolutely true. And the Tea Party demonstrations before that, which were often funded by the Koch brothers. So it's, again, we're back in the follow the money situation. The final story that I found this week that's really caught my attention is the way that people are using coronavirus statistics to compare the performance of different countries, when in fact, coronavirus statistics are incredibly inaccurate. Rather than counting cases, people are looking at death tolls as a better method of counting due to a lack of testing. But those death tolls are even undercounting the real number. Stanford University is releasing a preprint that's without peer review study that have found that 50 to 85 times more people have been infected with the virus than official figures are showing. And the ONS has just said today that more than 15% of coronavirus deaths are taking place outside of hospital. And often countries are not counting deaths outside of hospital. That would be including the United States. So another piece of less disinformation, more misinformation.
In some ways, I suppose the only reliable data might be the comparison between the normal seasonal death rates in particular countries. But then again, you know, can we be certain that countries are always as accurate as they should be at gathering that sort of information?
Well, indeed. And The Economist has a fantastic article on this, and they're promoting this idea that the best way is to look at what they call excess mortality. And according to that, they think that the U.S. death toll, for example, is 140% of what's been reported.
Wow, that's a big difference. I'd like to bring in the discussion our two guests today. Sasha Havlicek, who's the chief executive of the Institute of Strategic Dialogue, and then Edward Lucas, well-known writer and academic who's done a huge amount of writing and research on disinformation as a weapon used around the world, and both of whom I've worked with in my role as chair of the DCMS Select Committee. Sasha, I wonder if I could come to you first. Perhaps you could explain for us a little bit about the sort of work you do at the ISD in mapping and identifying and disrupting networks of disinformation.
Yes, thank you so much, Damien. It's wonderful to be with you on this Infotagen podcast. Just a little bit about what we do, and I suppose the tools that we use to understand information operations, influence operations, especially when they are covert, when they are manipulative in dark ways. So we combine a big data analytics architecture, which is really built for the purpose of detecting information operations across all of the sort of public parts of the internet that you'd imagine, from Facebook to Twitter and YouTube and Reddit and public Instagram and blogs and Google search. It integrates all of that data. But we also do a kind of snooping and ethnographic research across the darker bits of the web. So the Telegrams and 4chans and Discords and these sorts of platforms, where often you see some of the plotting and scheming being undertaken by malign groups. We combine that now with crowdsourced data. This is important, from WhatsApp groups and Facebook and YouTube. And that's quite important. That's about what people are seeing and able to report in on. It's in a way what Infotagen is trying to do, and I think really, really important. And then, of course, we look with OSINT methods to try and understand better, you know, who's behind this, who's financing this. Can we attribute these types of information operations? So just to say, beyond the kind of activity that everybody's seeing in terms of misinformation about cures or treatments, which continue to circulate widely on all the public platforms, beyond the attempts that we've seen at profiteering from the virus, where people are looking, through advertising and selling at great profit some of the things that people need at the moment in relation to the virus, we're really quite interested to understand better this political exploitation and manipulation of information related to COVID for the purposes of pushing a political agenda. And what we found is not dissimilar, as you said, to other contexts within which we see major cases of disinformation around elections, for instance. We see now with COVID a mass of both state-sponsored media and affiliated outlets and extremist movements mobilize. I mean, in many ways, I think this is to be expected because these certainly extremist movements look for any opportunity, any crisis to exploit to further their agenda. But we see a lot of that activity now, and I'd be happy to share with you some of those findings.
Yeah, and so is this people developing an existing political narrative around, you know, people that should be blamed for the ills of society?
Yes, I mean, you've just talked a little bit about some of the narratives that are being propagated by Russian and Chinese disinformation actors. So this is state-sponsored media. We see the same thing coming out of Iran. But when you look at two things. A massive conspiracy theories that are being propagated by both state actors, by governments. I mean, amazing amounts of conspiracy theories being propagated by governments in ways that we've really only ever seen in the past, coming out of some health disinformation actors, but really primarily out of extremist quarters. Mm-hmm. Now, state actors are doing a huge amount to propagate these types of quite mad conspiracy theories that you've mentioned some of them. But in terms of extremist mobilization, we see now a combination of far right white supremacist organizations, for instance, starting to sow the seeds of division and hatred. We see really quite explicit calls to violence, for instance, among white supremacist groups, with some terrible, real world implications. We see this awful situation in Missouri where a man was killed by the FBI plotting an attack on a hospital with COVID patients. And we see further calls for public attacks on public services and hospitals and so on, calls for white supremacists to turn themselves into bioweapons to target non-whites. We see anti-migration networks really mobilize against migrants in very specific contexts on the US-Mexican border or in the context of the Greek-Turkish refugee crisis. So there's a lot of this happening now in these environments.
In some ways, I mean, this really underlines one of the problems, that this is not just, bit of gossip, doesn't really matter, that you see on social media. There are real-world consequences for this that can lead to real harms. And we've talked in the past about the attacks on 5G mobile masts.
Yeah.
But this is, these are potential violent threats that could be delivered against real people as a consequence of these conspiracy theories on social media.
I think that it is, the risk of both political violence in the context, for instance, of the US and the mobilization now in the US around these movements that have just been mentioned, but also in relation to targeted attacks on specific constituencies. So there's a huge amount of anti-Chinese mobilization, anti-Jewish, anti-Muslim mobilization within these networks. And the challenge is that they're not just confined to the darker areas of the web where you'd expect them to be, perhaps around the 4chans and the 8chans and the Discord groups and Telegram. They are in fact proliferating much more, again, back out into the mainstream of social media, where they can have a really much more mainstream impact. And that's something to watch out for.
Yeah.
Just in terms of conspiracy theories, really wild conspiracy actors like QAnon have had some success in, again, getting mainstreaming their ideas. There's a kind of absolutely wild QAnon conspiracy around something called adrenochrome. And mentions of adrenochrome have now massively increased. So 895% increase on Instagram, 435% increase on Facebook. So you see these things starting to really have an impact. You've seen some of the reporting this last week. Avaaz identified, sadly, I mean, despite the efforts of the social media companies, and I think that they've done a lot to make sure that, outright disinformation is removed, and you're seeing a mass of content being removed in an automated way through their AI, you still see the proliferation of so much. And there was a report by Avaaz that talked about this kind of disinformation still reaching millions of people. we're in the process of finalising an investigation that we'll be putting out next week with BBC's Click, which will give us a sense of just how widespread and significant sort of Facebook interactions with websites hosting outright false information about the virus really is.
Okay, so well, certainly something to look out for, and I'm sure we'll want to make listeners aware of that when it gets published too, which we'll do through the Infotagen social accounts. But Edward, I'd like to bring you into the discussion. I remember when you gave evidence to the Select Committee a couple of years ago, talking in particular about Russian involvement in disinformation and fake news. You said then that we should always remember there's an internal audience for that, about how the Russian government wants people, its own citizens, to see the world and to see Russia. Do you think there is Russian involvement in disinformation around coronavirus, and what do you think the motivation is behind that? And perhaps also you can say something about China, because when we've talked about disinformation campaigns in Europe and the United States in the past, we've on the whole talked about them in the political context and talked about Russian involvement, but this is probably the first time we've really started to be exposed or think here about disinformation campaigns linked to China operating in the West as well.
Well, thanks very much, Damien, and congratulations, if I can just join the chorus of praise for your efforts, both this podcast and everything else. There clearly is a element of state-sponsored disinformation in this. I think one has to keep it in perspective, but let me just answer that first. So there's a very good piece on the Oxford University Computational Propaganda Project website about the Chinese, Iranian, Russian, and Turkish government media. And in each case, there's a sort of fairly similar pattern. It's praising what the country's done, rebutting criticism as being unfair, ill-informed, racist, or whatever, criticizing democracies for being corrupt and incompetent in their attitude to the treatment of the crisis, and then to some extent pushing conspiracy theories about the origins of the coronavirus and the way in which the authorities have reacted. And I think that's exemplified perhaps by the Chinese response, which was to come up with the startling allegation that the Wuhan outbreak has its roots in an American military visit there in October. And this is a sort of wild conspiracy theory being tweeted by the spokesperson of the Chinese foreign ministry. And that marked a sort of step change for the Chinese, that they were adopting what one might loosely call Russian tactics. Previous Chinese information operations have been tightly controlled and very much focused on promoting China as a strong, sensible partner that gets things done, and claiming that Japan and America are warmongers. But the new thing since this started has been to come up with lots of quite wild allegations against other countries. And I think probably taking the Russian playbook, that it's, if you can't get your own point across, at least make sure nobody believes anything just by spraying disinformation. But I think there's two bigger points which I'd just like to touch on briefly. The focus we now see on disinformation around the outbreak, I think, is very welcome, because it's made people realise what a serious problem we face. And looking at disinformation purely through the geopolitical lens, which people like you and me have done, has largely failed to capture public attention. Occasionally, like with the Salisbury attack in Salisbury or so on, people think, gosh, yes, the Russians do talk a lot of nonsense. But we now see this is an issue that affects everybody, and the misinformation and disinformation around it affect everybody. And this gives us a chance to highlight things. One of them is that information on its own is only part of the problem. There's always a other aspects. People are making money. There's a kinetic. People want stuff to happen in the real world. There's a political agenda, whatever. And so the cases that Sasha touched on, right-wing extremists are not just pumping out right-wing extremist propaganda or anti-Semitic propaganda. They actually want to blow things up and kill people and hurt people. So this idea that this links into wider influence operations is is very important. Another one is that we've tended to see these attacks as being something from outside, that, you know, we are basically sensible, and then someone from outside comes in and tries to sort of make us go crazy by putting crazy things into our information system. And again, this was a mistake. It's complacent, but the crisis has underlined it, because a lot of this stuff is not exogenous. It's not happening because someone in St. Petersburg or Beijing is pressing a button and doing stuff. We are generating this disinformation ourselves. It's our own crazy people. It's our own extremists. And if the outsiders are giving us following wind, or, you know, throwing a blazing brand into dry bush, well, yeah, we can criticize them for it, but, you know, let's not be under any illusions. I would say the bulk of this problem is stuff that we in our own societies are doing to ourselves.
And do you think there's a this is partly a legacy effect as well, that we've, you know, this is the first public health emergency in the age of social media disinformation, but it's happened after a number of years where networks of disinformation have been allowed to establish through social media, not interrupted at a significant scale, and provide a very fertile breeding ground for conspiracy theories?
Yes. I mean, I think what we've got is the consequence of the social fragmentation, lack of trust in the mainstream media and in authority figures generally, compounded by technological progress, which means the barriers to entry and the barriers to discovery have both become very low. And so now we see this really, we're reaping the harvest of those two things. New newspapers are closing all over the place. And, you know, and I saw a campaign on Twitter which said, you know, to mark the coronavirus, don't buy or watch any mainstream media for a week. So there's almost a sort of feeling that this is time to get back at the media for their real or imagined sins. And you can run these disinformation campaigns with absolutely zero friction and leaving almost no fingerprints. And, you know, we are still, and I'm still waiting to find out where the sort of, what was patient zero for the 5G link to the virus. That, I think that would be a fascinating thing, but it's really hard to discover that. And when we do try and do stuff, as the platforms are now trying, they're playing catch up very, you know, we can do a bit with, say, you know, Facebook's done some stuff on 5G, but I think we're only beginning to scratch the surface of what the platform is going to have to do to stop people sharing stuff, and particularly clicking on links that are shared that bring this sort of toxic nonsense into the mainstream public life.
And do you think there's been a bit of discussion around the official response of the Chinese government as well, particularly to the source of coronavirus, and saying that it should, you know, they won't really comment until there's a proper scientific investigation. But, you know, by default and rather than design, do you think in some ways that gives credence to some of the conspiracy theories, where they can say, well, there's no set view?
I mean, the boundary between a conspiracy theory and investigative journalism is very fuzzy, and a lot of the best investigative journalism was dismissed as conspiracy theories until it happened, until it was proved. And I think there's plenty of scope for digging on the origin of the virus. One of the key tests one always sets when one's doing proper investigative journalism is, what's the falsification? What would prove that my theory is wrong? And it's a hallmark of conspiracy theories is that they're not falsifiable. Whatever you come up with, people will say, oh, well, that's only because they're saying that. So you have at the beginning to set some sort of logical and factual benchmarks for how you test your hypothesis against the real world. But I do think that the secrecy and deceit in China is a very promising avenue for us to explore. We should keep on hammering away, not just at you know, where's patient zero and wet markets and so on, but also the extraordinary efforts the Chinese authorities have made to cover up what was happening, and also their attempts to intimidate the World Health Organization from playing its proper role as a watchdog, not least in its treatment of Taiwan.
I mean, just for really a question for all of our guests, you know, and Charles, and including Charles and John, I mean, do you think we, part of this is us actually thinking ourselves more about what we say and what we do? So part of that is, which we've tried to do with Infotagen, is to encourage people not just to share stuff if it looks interesting or it might be true, but to check it out before they share, because there could be inadvertently spreading lies, but also the language that we use, and actually for politicians and celebrities to start aping the language of the conspiracy theory, talking about mainstream media and so on, actually is giving credence to the conspiracies and helping fake news spread.
We've definitely seen some of that. You see politicians in particular, but also some mainstream media amplify conspiracy theories, amplify some of even the tropes from these extreme networks. But I wouldn't overdo that. There are orchestrated, organized attempts underway to influence the public's views on this. And they are happening in covert ways. And I think we need to be clear about that. It is a combination of covert and overt. What's interesting actually about the state disinformation that we see now is that it's in a way come out into the open. The majority of it, though there are instances of covert operations, the majority of it is propagandizing. It's very open propagandizing around falsehoods and conspiracy. But I think it's important to remember that where state and non-state actor mobilization and conspiracy theory actor mobilization is aligning is around certain key meta-narratives. And that's, I think, a challenge and important for us to be keeping a watchful eye on. It's around sowing mistrust in and delegitimizing liberal democratic governance and institutions. It's anti-internationalist, it's anti-globalization, it's a pro-nationalist agenda that's being touted, and it's ultimately pro-authoritarian. And so all of these tracks sort of lead in that direction. And as we see, I think, the risk of the flames of nationalism and authoritarianism being inflamed by this crisis, we need to really think harder than ever about what our vision for the good web, for the liberal democratic web should be, as we see the authoritarians' vision of the web, of course, come into play very forcibly around control and censorship.
Well, I just added this note because obviously I'm not breaking any state secrets to say that we're using Zoom to record these podcasts, and from the account recording from, there is the 40-minute time limit. But I've had a message from Zoom to say they've actually lifted that time limit. So whoever's listening in obviously approves of the discussion so far, which is reassuring.
Someone in China.
I for one welcome the interest of our new Chinese overlords in our discussion.
I think it's really important on this to all of us and Damien that we remember that what we're going through right now is a bit of a chaos moment. And in the midst of chaos moments, people are desperate to believe that there is some sense of order around them, that things aren't just wildly chaotic, even if that order might be malevolent. And that's a really rich and fertile ground for the spreading of disinformation.
Absolutely. Now, on that point, and John, I wonder if I could just bring you in as we're sort of coming towards the end of our time. But just from the invitation point of view, obviously this week we're also launching a sort of engagement campaign through social media and advertising to try and get people to think a bit more about what they're seeing and how they should respond to it. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, 100%. So I think it's based on a few of the things that the guys on this call have said, but I think what we're aiming for is why people share, and why people share that information, whether it's come from a bad actor or just is a sort of coincidence and someone random. But we're looking at how can we stop people, you know, sharing by just letting them stop and think really before they do so. So MNC Saatchi have partnered up with us, and we're launching a campaign around Isolate the Lies, which is obviously, again, an echo of, you know, what we do as a society to actually try and mitigate the problems of COVID itself in terms of isolation. We want to try and isolate the lies here that are being spread, because I think the misinformation, you know, as we've discussed on this podcast, can have real and sometimes very, very serious consequences. So that'll be going out this week and going out on our channels. And then a few partners have also given us some media channels as well. So it's, you know, very exciting, and hopefully we'll get to more people that way.
Absolutely. And I mean, as Edward said, I mean, a lot of this disinformation is not just the seed sown by bad actors from other countries. A lot of it is perpetuated and generated from within our own society as well.
Yeah, I think 100%, and that's what we're aiming to stop. I mean, I don't personally think Eamon Holmes is like a secret agent for the Russian government. But I think that some of the stuff that he's clearly reflecting some of the stuff that he's heard on social media. Like he's used the phrase, "It's all over Twitter," and that's something that we're trying to combat.
Exactly, he's pretty deeply embedded. If he is a but I know he's a Man United supporter, but as I am, but he's only a red in that sense, I think. Unfortunately, we'll have to end our discussion at that point. But Sasha, Edward, thank you very much for joining us, and great to have you, John and Charles, as always.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins MP, featuring John Quinlan, Dr. Charles Creel, Sasha Havlicek, and Edward Lucas. It was produced by Lucy and David Dagahi. You can find out more about Infotagent and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagent.com, or following us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.